Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is a special edition of our program. Today, honoring women throughout the world. A day to honor women. And I was thinking over the weekend, before I wrote these commentaries, and I'll also be sharing some insights today from Professor Paul Craig Roberts, from his.com, from Professor Henry Giroux on the domestic terrorism and youth in the politics of disposability from Truthout, also from Barry Lando, who had written something interesting I found on Winston Churchill, and also from a Professor Gerkaki Chingua. I will be sharing theirs and my own commentary. But when I was thinking about the marches and I heard some of the speeches, I thought how many of those women who were there in their minds for the right reason to show the empowerment of women will leave there and possibly go to a Starbucks or a McDonald's or Burger King or Kentucky Fried Chicken, any of the franchises. Maybe later or before, they would have stopped off in a box store. Getting there, they might have used a credit card from Citigroup or Bank America, one of the major corporations. And where they are living, what they're watching, what they're wearing, the clothes they're wearing. How many would have stopped and asked, where did this clothes come from? Did another woman have to suffer for me to buy this at a particular price? And those are the thoughts that I came away with, that a march is good, but what if no causes inspire us to go forward beyond that march? How much different the world would be if we made it our personal cause, even maybe 5-10 hours a week, which is doable for most people, to commit to something, even if it's one thing that we find important, not just for women, but for all people, and stay to it, because many of these efforts will take years, if not decades. Many of the things that you believe should be changed may not change in your lifetime, but it's important that we commit ourselves to something and stay the course. If you remember the great march against the war in Iraq, we had over 15 million people worldwide participating. The smallest number was in the United States. It's only about 400,000. Well, we had the march. We protested. But then the people in power knew that nothing would happen thereafter, and it didn't. And so they went about producing a war that's caused massive suffering. So what I want to do today is I'd like to share some insights. I'd like for you to hear from some women that I respect who are doing tremendously important work that 99.9% of the women are not even aware of. And these are people who are out there risking it all to help all people, not just women. You'll hear from them a little later on the program. But I want to show you that we've had a long history in the United States of having marches, a parade, if you will, that shows that people are concerned. For example, if you went back to 1913, we had the Women's Suffrage Parade. And according to LennyLetter.com and BusinessInsider.com, it was not a big event, but there was someone very special in there. It was Helen Keller. I'm sure everyone in this audience has heard of Helen Keller. She was one of 5,000 women who marched in the spirit of protest against the political organization of society from which women are excluded. Well, they lined up under banners representing their states and occupations and their organizations in Washington, D.C. There were 9 bands and 4 mounted brigades and 20 floats. Now, Keller wasn't the only famous woman in attendance. Jeanette Rankin marched under the Montana banner and would later come back 4 years later as the first U.S. Congresswoman. Ida B. Wells defiantly marched with with her state against instructions from organizers, Alice Paul and the National American Women's Suffrage Association, and white Southern members had insisted women of color should march in the back with a segregated unit. Mind you, this is a women's march, and yet at that time, there were women who were marching for one cause who were still supporting segregation as a separate issue, both in the same march. Most people are not aware of that. Another surprise, the tens of thousands of men in town for the inauguration of Woodrow Wilson had not been cleared from the streets, and those men, most of whom had been born with the right to vote, thought of the privilege as exclusively to their gender. And so they screamed and yelled and cursed at the women. In fact, they went out there and shoved them, pushed them, punched them, and the police did nothing. They stood by, as they normally do throughout many of these episodes. In fact, if you were to go to Saudi Arabia today and see a woman being accosted by another person, a man, they will not interfere. In fact, I would have liked to have seen women there showing what has happened to the women of the world who do not have the privileges and freedoms of a woman in the United States. We still have a lot of effort on behalf of women, but compared to Saudi Arabia? So I put up on my website over the weekend photographs of women's backs, buttocks, legs that had been beaten in public by for what we would consider non-infractions. If you were caught driving a car, if you were caught with, let's say, your face not fully covered, it can be for anything. And if you're caught talking with a person other than a member of your immediate family. And this goes on every single day. I also put a picture up of a gay man, blindfolded, his arms and legs behind his back, being thrown off a building in Saudi Arabia because he was gay. And so I would like to see members of the gay community speak out against, which they do, but we need to make it a national issue so the leaders in Washington doing business with these countries who think these are great people, like the Clintons, who took tens of millions of dollars from them and smiled. But not once did we hear the Clintons coming forward and saying this is a highly misogynist, terrible, perverse country ruled by the most radical, destructive, evil form of Islam, Wahhabism. And we should have nothing to do with this country. We should not sell it arms. We should not trade with it. In fact, that's a country we should put sanctions against, not Iran. But that won't happen until enough people protest and make that a point of view. Remember, what you're allowed to do in America to show your contempt using your freedom of speech, in any of these other countries, you'd be killed or jailed for. So let us not forget the brothers and sisters around the world who do not have our freedoms. In any case, over 100 women were beaten, and the Red Cross ambulances couldn't help them all because there were so many. But they stood up and they marched again. Then we had our bonus army march back in Washington in 1932. That's where tens of thousands of protesters, many of them from World War I, their veterans and their families, they were poor. And they simply went to Washington in the summer of 1932 to ask Congress, please give us their deferred bonuses. We need it, because they were in a depression. So the president wasn't happy about this, and he put his attack dog, Douglas MacArthur, that's the same MacArthur who was in World War II, he used tear gas and bayonets to oust the demonstrators, and that caused Hoover the election. The next president, of course, was Franklin D. Roosevelt. Then you had the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, August 28, 1963. About 250,000 people participated in the 1963 Civil Rights March in Washington, D.C., where Martin Luther King delivered his famous I Have a Dream speech. Now, I just want to digress for a moment on that, because when you consider that many of the people marching were marching from the Lincoln Memorial, and everyone has read a completely false narrative, in my opinion, of the history of Abraham Lincoln, real scholars will tell you there's a completely different story, which is rather ironic since the Lincoln Memorial is the sacred space for the Civil Rights Movement and the site of Martin Luther King's I Had a Dream speech. Now, according to Professor Paul Craig Roberts, we should pay attention. Why? Because Lincoln did not think blacks were the equal of whites. Now, that may come as a surprise, but it's true. Lincoln's plan was to send the blacks in America back to, I believe it was Liberia, in Africa. And if he had not been assassinated, he would be returning blacks to Africa. And as Professor Thomas DiLorenzo and a number of non-court historians have conclusively established, Lincoln did not invade the Confederacy in order to free the slaves. That's the official version. That's the fake news version. The Emancipation Proclamation did not occur until 1863, when opposition in the North to the war was rising despite Lincoln's police state measures to silence opponents and newspapers. And the Emancipation Proclamation was a war measure issued under Lincoln's war powers. And the proclamation provided for the emancipated slaves to be enrolled in the Union Army, replenishing its losses. It was also hoped that the proclamation would spread slave revolts in the South while Southern white men were away at war and draw soldiers away from the fronts in order to protect their women and children. So the intent was to hasten the defeat of the South before political opposition to Lincoln in the North grew stronger. So let me put this in a different perspective. The Lincoln Memorial was built not because Lincoln freed the slaves, but because Lincoln saved the empire. And as savior of the empire, had Lincoln not been assassinated, he would have been president for life. And it was Professor Thomas DiLorenzo who said, quote, "Lincoln spent his entire political career attempting to use the powers of the state for the benefit of the moneyed corporate elite, the one percenters of his day, first in Illinois and then in the North in general, through protectionist tariffs, corporate welfare for roads and canals and railroad corporations, and a national bank controlled by the politicians like himself to fund it all," end quote. So, like it or not, Lincoln was a man of empire. As soon as the South was conquered and ravaged and looted, his collection of war criminal generals, such as Sherman and Sheridan, set about exterminating the Plains Indians in one of the worst acts of genocide in human history. Even today, Israeli Zionists point to Washington's extermination of the Plains Indians as a model for Israel's theft of Palestine. The War of Northern Aggression was about tariffs and Northern economic imperialism. The North was protectionist. The South was free trade. The North wanted to finance its economic development by forcing the South to pay higher prices for manufactured goods. The North passed the Morrill Tariff, which more than doubled the tariff rate to 32.6% and provided for a further hike of 47%, or 247. And the tariff diverted the South's profits on its agriculture exports to the bank accounts of Northern industrialists and manufacturers. The tariff was designed to redirect the South's expenditures on manufactured goods from England to the higher-cost goods produced in the North. This is why the South left the Union, a right of self-determination under the Constitution. So the purpose of Lincoln's war was to save the Union, not to abolish slavery. And in his first inaugural address, Lincoln said, quote, "Made an ironclad defense of slavery. His purpose was to keep the South in the empire despite the Morrill Tariff. As for slavery, Lincoln is on the record. This is official, quote, I have no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere in the institution of slavery in the states where it exists. I believe I have no right to do so, and I have no inclination to do so," end quote. So this position, Lincoln reminded his audience, was part of the 1860 Republican platform. Lincoln also offered his support for the strong enforcement of the Fugitive Slave Act, which required Northerners to hunt down and return runaway slaves and he gave his support to the Corwin Amendment to the Constitution already passed by Northern votes in the House and Senate that prohibited any federal interference with slavery. For Lincoln and his allies, the empire was far more important than slaves. So just a little bit of history that we're not aware of. So in effect, in a civil war, both sides are fighting for control of the government. The South was not fighting for control of the federal government. The South was seceded, and the North refused to let the South go. So a lot of history has been falsified, and that's unfortunate. It's just one of those ironies. So anyhow, with these movements, the one thing I believe that should always be done, this is just my own preference, is always to acknowledge the people who came before you, who made substantial sacrifices, who did not have our protections and our guarantees, our First Amendment rights today. And as bad as it was for some people who are under constant surveillance for their activities, and you are, any of us who are active against any of government or corporate interest are on a local terrorist watch list. Imagine what it would have been like when they had no laws protecting them. So today I want to acknowledge, if it was not done at all the different women's marches, Harriet Tubman, the abolitionist, the humanitarian. By the way, she's also a spy, and she later helped lead the suffrage movement. Rosa Parks, who died in 2005, she was called the First Lady of Civil Rights and the mother of the freedom movement. Dorothy Day, who died in 1980, she was born in 1897, she founded the Catholic Worker Movement, and she was working for the poor in inner cities. How noble could that be? That, to me, makes her a hero. Korea Chapman Catt, who was died in 1947, the women's suffrage leader whose work gave women the 19th Constitutional Amendment for women to vote in 1920. She also founded the League of Women Voters and the International Alliance for Women. Audre Lorde, who died in 1992, an early founder of the black feminism, and she fought for lesbian recognition and the rights within African-American communities and civil rights activists. Lucretia Mott, a Quaker, a women's rights activist and social reformer. She conducted the first convention on women's rights in the United States in 1848. That should be someone's work that we know, that we study. And again, if you're not familiar with Mott and her work, please read it. Madams C.J. Walker, first African-American self-made millionaire, and she turned her energy toward civil rights. She became an activist, and she was a philanthropist for black causes. Dora Russell. By the way, Dora Russell was the wife of one of the greatest minds ever, Bertrand Russell, one of my favorite philosophers. And she was a British activist and an advocate for birth control with H.G. Wells and Johann Maynard Keynes. And she was prominent during the post-World War II peace movement in fighting for nuclear disarmament. Nina Simone, I'm sure most people in this audience know her because she would actually include a lot of the black struggle and Jim Crow laws in her songs. And she was more inspired by the radicalism of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. June Jordan, the Jamaican immigrant and poet, became known as Poet for the People. She gave substance to the feminist theory. Sarah Moore Grimke, the abolitionist, became a lawyer, and one of the first women to ever become a lawyer. She was born in 1792, and she was one of the most important people in history in the women in America and the women's rights movement. Marianne Shad. Shad was a Canadian anti-slave activist and a lawyer. She was the first black woman publisher in North America and one of the first to create a radically integrated school in defiance of racism. Henrietta Edwards, Canadian feminist who fought for women to be recognized as persons under the law and got women the right to vote. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, two great women's suffrage movement leaders and the founders of the National Women's Suffrage Association. But there are some who, I believe most of these people are alive today. I can't be certain for everyone, but Angela Davis, in my opinion, a hero, political activist, a scholar, and an icon for African-American women. Dolores Huerta, American Latino labor and civil rights activist who co-founded the National Farm Workers Association. Now that's the United Farm Workers area, and she also was a big one for immigration and women's rights. Winona LaDuc, Native American activist on environmental economics. By the way, if you don't know her, she was Ralph Nader's vice presidential candidate in 2000 and executive director of the organization Honor the Earth. Marion Wright Edelman, civil rights activist on behalf of children and the disadvantaged. She founded the Children's Defense Fund. Kate Millett, author of the 1970s Sexual Politics and one early advocate for mental health reform for women and reform of nursing homes. And Media Benjamin, who she's very much active and alive. I met with Media. Together, there were four of us, Ralph Nader and she and Professor Robert Thurman, who met with Gerald Salante to start. We formed Occupy Peace and Prosperity up in Kingston, and it's going strong. She founded Code Pink, and I have a lot of respect for Media. Now, I don't know if she's still alive, but if she is, I met her several times long ago. Ruby Dee, she is an actress, poet, playwright. She was a friend of both Martin Luther King and Malcolm, and she's been arrested many times at civil rights protests, and she was very active in the black movements. And Lynn Twist, very important in indigenous women's rights, but also Naomi Klein, Naomi Wolf, Jill Stein, and so many others. But look around the world, because it's not just in America. We have Vandana Shiva, the international Indian food and women's activist, mostly GMOs and anti-nuclear. And you also have Aylin Ali, the Somalian feminist, member of the Dutch parliament, opponent to female mutilation and radical Islam. And you have one of the leading Pakistani feminists, Malala, struggled against the Taliban for having girls educated. By the way, she was the youngest person to ever win the Nobel Peace Prize. She was 18. Jane Goodall, the human voice as the ambassador of animals in the world. No one's done as much as Jane has when it comes to protecting those wonderful, beautiful, sentient creatures. She is a hero. Manasseh Pradhan, leading the Indian women's movement against violence and rape against Indian women. She won the Global Outstanding Woman Award. And then you have Huda Shah Arari, Egyptian feminist, leader, the founder of the Egyptian Feminist Union, especially against sexual practices such as harems. And she opened the first women's school in Egypt in 1910. And she opposed patriarchal Islamic ideologies. Imagine that in a country that was extremely, a theocracy. And then you have the Liberian peace and women's activists and the mobilizer of women of Liberian mass action for peace. And she is Lamaha Gowi. And then you have Susan Sarandon. There are celebrities who show up who I have not personally observed doing much for women, but doing a lot for themselves. Madonna's one. But there are women celebrities I do respect who have done a great deal. Susan Sarandon, Daryl Hannah, Joan Baez, Patti Smith, Jane Fonda, Amal Clooney, Jenny McCarthy. There are others. I just wanted to let you know that sometimes when we're caught up in the moment of a march, a demonstration, we forget that there are people who have been marching throughout history, and that we wouldn't probably be in a place to have marches today if there weren't people who made sacrifices before us. So it's not just about leaving a march and saying we did our thing. No, we don't do our thing unless we sustain it and we become active at the local level. Now, there's some things I believe that we can take away from these marches so that when people go home, the men and women go home from these marches, the women can work with the men and other women they know to form small groups, small collectives. And here are some of the issues I would like to put forth that should be addressed. and can be. For example, we should have make sure that at the federal level, there is no legislation that interferes with a woman's use of her body. And that means from reproductive freedom and against mandated vaccines. And that means if all the women in California who believed in women's rights and freedom, then you should march on the Capitol and you should tell those absolutely abysmal corrupt legislators and your twirly little governor out there, you have sold us out. You have no control over our bodies. And yet you've acted because of the corruption of the pharmaceutical industry and paying all these legislators to make it mandated we put toxins in our body that shouldn't belong there. I think that's a big issue. Now, if you become well-educated, and there's plenty of material now to become well-educated, Barbara Lou Fisher's organization, my own website, I have 41 articles I've personally written with our scholars in residence, such as Richard Gale and Jeremy and others. Educate yourself about the dangers of vaccines. It's one thing to accept what your nurse, pharmacist, or physician says, but they're as ill-informed as anyone else. And one day you end up with a child that is no longer normal and would never have been protected in any case because the vaccines are not shown to be safe and effective. I think that's one area that a lot of people could relate to once they get their facts. Get your facts. Do your homework. Be as critical in your judgment at everything you read. Is it documented? Is it independent? And then go forward from there. We also need opposition, massive opposition to our American educational program. We need access to equal education for all kids and stop completely all of these stupid dumbing down programs of only thing is there to test kids and let's get them back to what education should be, the capacity for critical thinking. And we need that desperately. We could be against chemicals and cosmetic products, chemicals in our foods and in the things that our children touch, bottles and crayons, and to clean all those chemicals up. And especially important are chemicals in a pregnant woman's body and how that can lead to deformities and miscarriages. We can look at, is it better to have healthy, local, organically grown food to support local markets, or better to have industrialized mono farming with a GMO and pesticides? If you showed anyone both side by side and how one was created and the other, I'm quite sure most people would make that a movement. And we do have a movement. As one example, in Colorado, the documentary, which is up on our website for you to watch, and it's free, Seeds of Death, has been shown 81 times on the PBS station in Colorado Public Television. And it's still showing because, as the producer of the station said, people love to know things they didn't know. It's a whole education. So we need to educate ourselves about GMOs. We also need to support women in their maternity leave for work and also support paternity leave for dads, as in some countries. We need efforts to expose the dangers of mammography and the entire mammography industry. We need to work for women's safety in the workplace, equal opportunity in decreasing the gender wage gap, lack of affordable and competent child care, breastfeeding and why it's so better, much better than infant formula. And we should have universal health care so every human being, every woman, child, any age, no matter what their condition, they're covered for life without having to pay a penny out of their own pockets. We need to learn lessons about the division of domestic labor. Working moms still do far more of domestic care than husbands. And I think that's the final frontier in feminism. Equal work at home. So every man and every woman should equalize the work so it's not the burden of one. We also should work on causes and support organizations opposing domestic violence, stalking, and harassment. Women's legal organizations that are good and are out there, support them, trying to increase the conviction rate of rape cases, which right now is extremely low. Reform of women's prisons and the treatment of women in prison. I believe that based upon the best science I could find, 50 to 60% of all women in prison are there for drugs and nonviolent crimes. They shouldn't be in prison at all. They should be in therapies to help them. They should be in detox to cleanse their body and break them of the addiction cycle. They should be in support systems within their communities. And they should be helping the local community as service, not ever in prison. We should look for an effort to stop global genital mutilation, because it's around the world. We should also stop all sex-selective abortions. There's as many as 5 million babies that are female that are aborted every year in India alone. We should also boycott any country that discriminates against gays, punishes them, and especially Saudi Arabia, that kills them. By the way, they're not the only ones. There are several that will kill and imprison for life homosexuals in the Middle East. We should boycott completely Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, and Qatar. We should take money, all women and men should take your money out of the big banks, tear up their credit cards, and put it in state banks, credit unions. Divest your investments from regressive capitalist causes. Stop shopping in megastores. Buy American, buy local, buy fair trade. Local food projects to relieve the suffering of 70 million women and children in the United States who are on the brink or below poverty right now. Let's support those women and the children. There's 16.8 million hungry children every day in the United States, 2.4 million homeless children every day in the United States. Certainly, with all the women and the women of power, that could make a difference. We also need to support anti-fracking, anti-nuclear, anti-coal efforts around the United States. Become really involved in your environment. Let us start looking for progressive politicians at the state, local levels, and support local grassroots efforts. Let us support exclusively third-party campaigns. And women are severely underrepresented in political life. Let's support progressive women. After all, I think that there is a big disconnect when women say, I want to vote for Hillary Clinton. Why? Well, because she's a woman. But what if I named you 100 women who are better qualified, who are more humane, who are not warmongers, who are not in alignment? And then I say this, you are aware that every single major Wall Street bank, every single pharmaceutical company, every single one of the major industries, hydrofracking, coal, oil, all the major insurance companies, all lined up to support Hillary Clinton. Why? Because they knew that she has always been there with her husband to support them. Now, I want to digress for a moment. I want to give you just an example of what happens when you don't know enough about a person. One of the individuals that has been in a position of power has been Hillary Clinton, and she prided herself on being the co-president. She made that very clear. Well, she was co-president of NAFTA then, and how did that work? And CAFTA, and she was promoting the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So her corporate international globalist neoliberal agenda is clear. But here's something you didn't know. In fact, no one in this audience knows. And I want to share this with you now. This is from Mark Curtis, and it's from Web of Deceit. And I'll just do a short segment. It's contributing to genocide in Rwanda. After the killings began in early April 1994, the UN Security Council, instead of beefing up its peace mission in the country and giving it a stronger mandate to intervene, stop the killing, decided to reduce the troop presence from 2,500 to 270. This decision sent a green light to those who had planned the genocide that the UN would not intervene. The small UN military force arrived merely to rescue expats and then left. Belgium's senior army officer at the UN peace mission believed that if this force had not been pulled out, the killings would never have happened. Canadian General Romeo Dallaire, who commanded the UN force in Rwanda, later said that this evacuation showed, quote, inexcusable apathy by the sovereign states that made up the UN that is completely beyond comprehension and moral acceptability. And also, it was Hillary and Bill Clinton who refused to call it genocide. Had they called it genocide, the entire UN and its laws about genocide would have been invoked. So every time they got reports of how many people were being killed, they said that they would not move on it. So it was not just here in the United States. It was also people who are responsible, in my opinion, who should be in prison for life because of what they did, are the British. Now, the little diminutive, corrupt people who were part of this would be Madeleine Albright, because she was the voice of the Clintons. She was in the ambassador to the United Nations. She knew genocide was occurring, and she did nothing about it. She's been at every one of Hillary Clinton's rallies. She's on the network, and no media has ever held her accountable. Not once. Why? She's a genocidalist. And here's what one of the individuals said. Said, no force was standing. My forces were standing knee-deep in mutilated bodies, surrounded by the guttural moans of dying people, looking into the eyes of dying children, bleeding to death with their wounds burning in the sun and being invaded by maggots and flies. I found myself walking through villages where the only sign of life was a goat or a chicken or a songbird, as all the people were dead, their bodies being eaten by voracious packs of wild dogs, end quote. Now, the UN was supposed to take 5,500 troops there, but they were stopped. They were supposed to be deployed. They were stopped. The U.S. ambassador, Madeleine Albright, Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton were responsible for this, and they had help from the British. The British finally agreed that they would deliver not people to stop the killing, but 50 trucks. This is a Linda Schalker, then Minister for Overseas Development, went to Rwanda, saw the genocide, came back and said, quote, I was up to my knees in bodies by then. And what were the trucks for? To take the dead people out or to allow the people who were there some safe passage out? Never got there. So I'll give you one example, because I watched the documentary on him. And in one scene, you see the troops, the Italian troops, I believe, leaving from protecting about 2,200 of the Tutsis who were in a church, Catholic church, and outside banging machetes against their leg with the Hutus, just waiting for the troops to leave. Well, the UN general wanted to go in and protect them. He was told to stand down. So his 270 men had to stand there and watch as the last of the Italian troops left. Every single one of those 2,200 people were slaughtered, chopped to death. They would bring people down in front of the UN building, and they would put women in a circle, and they would hack the women, and they wouldn't give them a fatal hack. They would give them a bleeding hack. All day long, the men would just hack these women until finally, by the end of the evening, all the women were dead. Now, the UN soldiers could have shot these guys, could have gone out, could have rescued these people. They were told, stand down. I could list 50 other instances where they could have stopped it. They found the weapons that were going to be used, and they were told, stand down. So Hillary Clinton, aside from her and Bill having had the death of 500,000 Iraqi children on their hands from their efforts, now have 800,000 to 900,000 deaths on their hands, along with Madeleine Albright. Is that the woman? Is that the spiritual feminist? Is that the person looking out for all women's rights around the world? That's the woman who took money from the men in Saudi Arabia, the royal family, that kills gays and women? So I believe the time for this absolute ridiculous hypocrisy stops. There are plenty of great women in this world. She just isn't one of them. Now, I want to go a little further. I want to play you a piece about the kind of women we should be listening to. This is a woman who stands up for the truth, stands up against the political forces, and if more women supported her efforts and got involved based upon what she exposes, because she goes out and finds the crimes against humanity and she exposes them. She is absolutely fearless. This is Abby Martin.
Ring role in the U.S. intelligence report, almost a third of it, is dedicated to describing RT's alleged efforts to, quote, fuel discontent in the U.S. It goes on to accuse some former programs of being overwhelmingly critical of American and Western governments for years. Well, let's now, in fact, hear from Abby Martin, who was the host of one of the named shows Breaking the Sets. Abby, nice to see you again. It's been a while, though, hasn't it? Your show has not been running on RT for, what, 2 years now, yet it was still one of the programmes singled out in the US intelligence report, as we said. You weren't shy, were you, to express your views, but is it fair to say that what you did here in RT was part of the Kremlin's effort to, quote, influence politics and what they're saying also fuel discontent?
It's incredible. You know, I've never actually gotten direction from Putin himself or coordinated with the Kremlin. But I will say, as a passionate young American at the time that RT picked me up, I was trying to present issues that affected Americans and their communities like reporters in a vibrant democracy should be able to do. So, you know, this whole report just reeks of desperation. It's lashing out on behalf of the establishment. Like you said, a third of it is full of bashing RT. It is absolutely insane, ridiculous, embarrassing, to say the least.
Following the report, the New York Times issued an article with its own analysis of RT's work, again mentioning you, saying that you quit on air after denouncing Russia's actions in Ukraine. But there was a sizable period before that.
Absolutely. I mean, here's the thing, is that I've always been open with management. I talked to my management about what I wanted to say. I went on air, voiced my opinion. And that's what I did every day. I voiced my opinions and I continued to voice my opinions after that. So the New York Times is no stranger to false narratives. They latched onto this report. Not only did they call it surprisingly damning and detailed, they also had to add that, of course, it contained no evidence. But the next day after they published this, you know, staunch defense of the intelligence community, like it always does, so-called paper of record, they actually followed up with a piece claiming that two anchors quit live on air and denounced RT as propaganda. Of course, that is completely false. They didn't even reach out to me. And I was a main part of this story to bolster this narrative in order to defend the intelligence report. So I was really, really appalled to see not only was my entire work on RT misconstrued.
Now, Abby, there is Abby Martin simply being attacked by the New York Times, being attacked by Washington, the CIA, by name. Why? Because she has the courage to call out the truth on any topic. She's meticulous in her research. She is scholarly. And she brings a sense of dynamic, no compromise to what she does. So we're going to be playing a part of her challenge to Rachel Maddow on tomorrow's program. And then I will give you a commentary after that on how Rachel Maddow and the entire corporate left are on the wrong side of truth and history. And I will go through history to show you false flags, where they happen, who was responsible, and our intervention in other regimes, because it seems though they can't find any conspiracies that are real. Well, we can. And Abby Martin has as well. So I believe that we need a lot more Abby Martins, a lot more. Following Hannah Arendt and I, a dark cloud of political and ethical ignorance has descended on the United States. And I'm going to conclude our program today to give us a little different insight into what many people are feeling, the angst, the anger, the confusion, what is possible. And I will continue with some of this on tomorrow's program. Henry Giroux's extremely articulate voice, like Chris Hedges, and I'm going to share some of Chris's insights also on tomorrow's program. But when you look at the world today and you look at the what we're doing to our youth, I believe that it is a reckless pursuit. Thoughtlessness has become something that now occupies a privileged, if not celebrated, place in the political landscape and the mainstream cultural apparatuses. What do I mean? A new kind of infantilism now shapes daily life as adults gleefully take on the role of unthinking children, and children are taught to be adults, stripping them of their innocence and subject to a range of disciplinary pressures designed to cripple their ability to be imaginative. Under such circumstances, agency devolves into a kind of anti-intellectual cretinism, evident in the babble of banality produced by Fox or MSNBC or the celebrity culture, or schools modeled after prisons and politicians who support creationism, or argue against climate change and denounce almost any form of reason, the citizen now becomes a consumer, the politician, a slave to corporate money and power, and the burgeoning army of anti-public intellectuals and the mainstream media present themselves as unapologetic enemies of anything that suggests compassion and respect for the commons and democracy itself. Education is no longer a public good. It is a private right, just as critical thinking is no longer a fundamental necessity for creating an engaged and socially responsible citizenship. Neoliberalism's disdain for the social is no longer a quote from, let's say, Margaret Thatcher. The public sphere is now replaced by private interest, and unbridled individualism rails against any viable notion of solidarity that might inform the vibrancy of struggle and change and an expansion of an enlightened and democratic body politic. One outcome is that we live at a time in which institutions that were designed to limit human suffering and dignity and protect the public from boom and bust cycles of capitalist markets have been either weakened or abolished. Free market policies, values, and practices, with their now unrestrained emphasis on the privatization of public wealth and the denigration of social protections and the deregulation of economic activity, and influence practically every commanding political and economic institution in North America, has led us down the rabbit hole. Yes, finance capitalism now drives politics, governance, and policy in unprecedented ways and is more than willing to sacrifice the future of young people for short-term political and economic gain, regardless of the talk about the need to not burden future generations. Under market fundamentalism, there is a separation of market values and behavior and practices from ethical considerations and social costs, giving rise to a growing theater of cruelty and abuse throughout North America. Public spheres that once encouraged progressive ideas, enlightened social policies and democratic values, and critical dialogue and exchange have been increasingly commercialized, or they have been replaced by corporate settings whose ultimate fidelity is to the increasing profit margins and producing a vast commercial and celebrity culture that tends to function so as to erase everything that matters. Now, have you noticed that since the 1980s, the scale of human suffering and immiseration and hardship has intensified, accompanied by a theater of cruelty in which violence, especially the daily spectacle of black men being brutalized or killed by the police, feeds the 24-hour news cycle? The tentacles of barbarianism appear to be reaching into every aspect of our daily life, and domestic terrorism has come home, and it increasingly targets the young. So given these conditions, an overwhelming catalog of evidence has come into view that indicates that nation-states organized by neoliberal priorities have implicitly declared war on their children, offering a disturbing index of societies in the midst of a deep moral and political catastrophe. Tomorrow, for example, I will show you a clip from Women in Black, a very courageous, extraordinarily dedicated group of women from around the world who go to Israel and go to the West Bank and Gaza to bring their stories to the world public and to try to bear witness to the suffering that is occurring there. And it's really bad for the children. But so too is it bad if you're an inner city child today coming into poverty, and that becomes your legacy. Too many young people today live in an era of foreclosed hope, an era in which it is difficult either to imagine a life beyond the dictates of a market-driven society or to transcend the fear that any attempt to do so could only result in a more dreadful nightmare. As Jennifer Silva has pointed out, this generation of especially young working-class men and women are trying to figure out what it means to be an adult in a world of disappearing jobs, soaring education costs, and shrinking social support networks. They live at home longer, spend more years in college, change jobs more frequently, and start families later. Youth today are not only plagued by the fragility and uncertainty of the present, they are the first post-war generation facing the prospect of downward mobility, in which the plight of the outcast stretches to embrace a generation as a whole. It's little wonder that these youngsters are called Generation Zero, a generation with zero opportunities, zero future, zero expectations, or to use Guy Standing's term, the precariat, which he defines as a growing proportion of total society forced to accept a life of unstable labor and unstable living. Beyond exposing the moral depravity of a society that fails to provide for its youth, the symbolic and real violence waged against many young people suggests nothing less than a perverse collective death wish, especially visible when youth protest their conditions. We live in an era in which there is near zero tolerance for democratic protest and infinite tolerance for crimes of bankers and government embezzlers, which affects the lives of millions. It was interesting in the hearings that I watched where they were questioning the new housing secretary and the new treasury secretary, and both had exploited the free market to take advantage of people's home foreclosures, especially the gentleman who, I believe, is going to become Secretary of Treasury, who owned a Las Vegas bank and was asked about all the foreclosed homes in Las Vegas. That was the wrong question to ask. That was a mundane politician asking a really limited question. The larger question that needs to be asked is, in a country where 24 million people, over 7 million people, lost their homes, why was there no outrage? Why were there no protests? Why were there no marches in solidarity for those people to bring the government to a point where they stopped the foreclosure, protected those people, let them stay in their homes, and gave them an opportunity with whatever income they had to pay maybe a 15% for rent to live in those homes, to keep those neighborhoods vital, to keep those people from couch surfing on people's couches? But they didn't do that. It's as if we care about the person who profited from the expulsion of people, but we don't care about America watching the process, as if this were Nazi Germany in the 1930s or Italy in the 1920s, and people are looking out the window to see who they're coming for next, instead of getting out there and organizing and protesting. That's why these marches were so important. They're there as a moment of expression. So beyond exposing this moral depravity, what we need is, we need this. This is certainly true in the United States. We need to become aware of what represents the true terrorism, the terrorism of a market-driven economy, where if you can't pay for something, you can't have it, where the rights of life are limited by what parts of life have now been privatized and commercialized. And what happens when you don't belong to that group, and how you are categorized, and how you are diced and sliced in information bits to be sold. Now, the FBI and Wall Street and the Justice Department doesn't seem to find that the banking giant HSBC, which laundered hundreds of billions of dollars from Mexican drug cartels and terrorist groups linked to Al-Qaeda, not a single person went to jail. They just paid a fine and walked free. Well, then why don't you give the same opportunity to anyone else that commits any other crime in the United States? Pay a fine, walk free, or do community service, walk free. Well, no, that's a different standard, they say. So we have two standards. If you're rich, if you're a Clinton, if you're a Madeleine Albright, if you're a Condoleezza Rice, if you're a person in power, you have a different set of rights. And you see this. If you were once the repository of society's dreams, there is no longer the truth of that. Increasingly, young people are viewed as a public disorder, a dream now turned into a nightmare. Many youth live in a post-9/11 social order that positions them as a prime target of its governing through crime complex. This is made obvious by the many get-tough policies that now render young people as criminals while depriving them of basic health care and education and social services. Surely we can see this. Punishment and fear have replaced compassion and social responsibility as the most important modalities for mediating the relationship of youth to the larger social order, all too evident by the usurped of zero-tolerance laws, along with the expanding reach of the punishing state in both the United States and Canada. And when the criminalization of social problems becomes a mode of governance and war its default strategy, youth are reduced to soldiers or targets, not social investments. I believe it was anthropologist Alain Berthaud who said, youth is no longer considered the world's future, but is a threat to its present. In conclusion, increasingly, the only political discourses available for many young people are either a disciplinary one or one of emotional self-management. Youth are now removed from any talk about democracy. Their absence is symbolic of a society that has turned against itself, punishes its children to death so at the risk of crippling the entire body politic. Too many youth now represent the absent present in any discourse about the contemporary moment and the future and democracy itself, and they increasingly all fall prey to what I call the war on youth, a war that can be traced back to the 1970s. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day.